We have no idea where your wife and son are as of right now, Bannerman said, and Vic suddenly felt all of his guts drop back into place. The world took on a little of its former color. He began to tremble. The unlit cigarette jittered between his lips. What's going on? What do you know? You're Bannerman, you said? Castle County Sheriff, that's right. And I'll try to put you in the picture if you'll give me a minute. Yes, okay. Now he was afraid. Everything seemed to be going too fast. Officer Fisher was dispatched to your home at 83 Latch Street as per your request at 12:34 this morning. He ascertained that there was no car in the driveway or in the garage. He rang the front doorbell repeatedly, and when there was no answer, he let himself in using the key over the porch eave. He found that the house had been severely vandalized. Furnishings were overturned, liquor bottles broken, soap powder had been poured over the floor and the built-ins of the kitchen. Jesus, Kemp, Vic whispered. His whirling mind fixed on the note, "Do you have any questions?" He remembered thinking that note, regardless of everything else, was a disquieting index into the man's psychology, a vicious act of revenge for being dumped. What had Kemp done now? What had he done besides go through their house like a harpy on a warpath? Mr. Trenton? I'm here. Bannerman cleared his throat as if he were having some difficulty with the next. Officer Fisher proceeded upstairs. The upstairs had not been vandalized, but he found traces of some whitish fluid, most probably semen, on the bedspread in the master bedroom. And in an unwitting comic ellipsis, he added, the bed did not appear to have been slept in. Where's my wife? Vic shouted into the phone. Where's my boy? Don't you have any idea? Take it easy, Roger said, and put a hand on Vic's shoulder. Roger could afford to say take it easy. His wife was home in bed, so were his twin girls. Vic shook the hand off. Mr. Trenton, all I can tell you right now is that a team of state police detectives are on the scene, and my own men are assisting. Neither the master bedroom nor your son's room appear to have been disturbed. Except for the cum on our bed, you mean, Vic said savagely, and Roger flinched as if struck. His mouth dropped open in a gape. Yes, well, that, Bannerman sounded embarrassed. But what I mean is that there are no signs of, violence against person or persons. It looks like straight vandalism. Then where are Donna and Tad? The harshness was now breaking up into bewilderment, and he felt the sting of helpless little boy tears at the corners of his eyes. At this time, we have no idea. Kemp. My God, what if Kemp has them? For just a moment, a confusing flash of the dream he'd had the previous night recurred. Donna and Tad hiding in their cave, menaced by some terrible beast. Then it was gone. If you have any idea of who might be behind this, Mr. Trenton. I'm going out to the airport and rent a car, Vic said. I can be there by 5 o'clock. Patiently, Bannerman said, yes, Mr. Trenton, but if your wife and son's disappearance is somehow connected with this vandalism, time could be a very precious commodity. If you have even the slightest idea of who might bear a grudge against you and your wife, either real or imagined. Kemp, Vic said in a small, strangled voice. He couldn't hold the tears back now. The tears were going to come. He could feel them running down his face. Kemp did it. I'm sure it was Kemp. Oh, my Christ, what if he's got them? Who is this Kemp? Bannerman asked. His voice was not embarrassed now. It was sharp and demanding. He held the phone in his right hand. He put his left hand over his eyes, shutting out Roger, shutting out the hotel room, the sound of the TV, everything. Now he was in blackness, alone with the unsteady sound of his voice and the hot, shifting texture of his tears. "Steve Kemp," he said. "Stephen Kemp. He ran a place called the Village Stripper there in town. He's gone now. At least my wife said he was gone. He and my wife, Donna, they had an affair, banging each other. It didn't last long. She told him it was over. I found out because he wrote me a note. It was a pretty ugly note. He was getting his own back, I guess. I guess he didn't like to get brushed off much. It sounds like a grander version of that note." He rubbed his hand viciously across his eyes, making a galaxy of red shooting stars. "Maybe he didn't like it that the marriage didn't just blow apart, or maybe he's just fucked up. Donna said he got fucked up when he lost a tennis match, wouldn't shake hands over the net. It's a question." Suddenly his voice was gone, and he had to clear his throat before it would come back. There was a band around his chest, tightening and loosening, then tightening again. "I think it's a question of how far he might go. He could have taken them, Bannerman. He's capable of it, from what I know of him." There was a silence at the other end. No, not quite silence. The scratching of a pencil on paper. Roger put his hand on Vic's shoulder again, and this time he let it stay, grateful for the warmth. He felt very cold. "Mr. Trenton, do you have the note Kemp sent you?"
"No, I tore it up. I'm sorry, but under the circumstances..."
"Was it by any chance printed in block letters?"
"Yes. Yes, it was."
"Officer Fisher found a note written in block letters on the message board in the kitchen. It said, 'I left something upstairs for you, baby.'"
Vic grunted a little.
The last faint hope that it might have been someone else, a thief or maybe just kids, blew away. "Come on upstairs and see what I left on the bed." It was Kemp. The line on the note minder at home would have fit right into Kemp's little note. "The note seems to indicate that your wife wasn't there when he did it," Bannerman said. But even in his shocked state, Vic heard a false note in the sheriff's voice.
"She could have walked in while he was still there, and you know it," Vic said dully. "Back from shopping, back from getting the carb adjusted on her car, anything."
"What sort of car did Kemp drive, do you know?"
"I don't think he had a car. He had a van."
"Color?"
"I don't know."
"Mr. Trenton, I'm going to suggest you come on up from Boston. I'm going to suggest that if you rent a car, you take it easy. It would be one hell of a note if your people turned up just fine and you got yourself killed on the interstate coming up here."
"Yes, all right."
He didn't want to drive anywhere, fast or slow. He wanted to hide. Better still, he wanted to have the last 6 days over again.
"Another thing, sir."
"What's that?"
"On your way up here, try to make a mental list of your wife's friends and acquaintances in the area. It's still perfectly possible that she could be spending the night with someone."
"Sure."
"The most important thing to remember right now is that there are no signs of violence." "The whole downstairs is ripped to hell," Vic said.
"That sounds pretty fucking violent to me."
"Yes," Bannerman said uncomfortably.
"Well, I'll be there," Vic said. He hung up.
"Vic, I'm sorry," Roger said.
Vic couldn't meet his old friend's eyes.
Wearing the horns, he thought. Isn't that what the English call it? Now Roger knows I'm wearing the horns.
It's all right, Vic said, starting to dress.
All this on your mind, and you went ahead with the trip?
What good would it have done to stay home? Vic asked.
It happened. I only found out on Thursday. I thought some distance, time to think, perspective. I don't know all the stupid goddamn things I thought. Now this.
Not your fault, Roger said earnestly.
Rog, at this point I don't know what's my fault and what isn't. I'm worried about Donna and I'm out of my mind about Tad. I just want to get back there. And I'd like to get my hands on that fucker Kemp.
His voice had been rising. It abruptly sank. His shoulders sagged. For a moment he looked drawn and old and almost totally used up. Then he went to the suitcase on the floor and began to hunt for fresh clothes.
Call Avis at the airport, would you, and get me a car? My wallet's there in the nightstand. They'll want the American Express number.
I'll call for both of us. I'm going back with you.
No.
But nothing.
Vic slipped into a dark blue shirt. He had it buttoned halfway up before he saw he had it wrong. One tail hung far below the other. He unbuttoned it and started again. He was in motion now, and being in motion was better, but that feeling of unreality persisted. He kept having thoughts about movie sets, where what looks like Italian marble is really just contact paper, where all the rooms end just above the camera's sight line, and where someone is always lurking in the background with a clapperboard.
Scene number 41, Vic convinces Roger to keep on plugging, take one. He was an actor, and this was some kind of crazy absurdist film. But it was undeniably better when the body was in motion.
Hey, man. Roger, this changes nothing in the situation between Hadworks and the Sharp Company. I came along after I knew about Donna and this guy Kemp, partly because I wanted to keep up a front. I guess no guy wants to advertise when he finds out his wife has been getting it on the side. But mostly because I knew that the people who depend on us have to keep eating, no matter who my wife decides to go to bed with.
Go easy on yourself, Vic. Stop digging yourself with it.
I can't seem to do that, Vic said. Even now, I can't seem to do that.
And I can't just go on to New York as if nothing's happened.
As far as we know, nothing has. The cop kept emphasizing that to me. You can go on. You can see it through. Maybe it'll turn out to have been nothing but a charade all along, but people have to try, Roger. There's nothing else to do. Besides, there's nothing you can do back in Maine except hang out.
Jesus, it feels wrong. It feels all wrong.
It's not. I'll call you at the Biltmore as soon as I know something.
Vic zippered his slacks and stepped into his loafers.
Now go on and call Avis for me. I'll catch a cab out to Logan from downstairs. Here, I'll write my Amex number down for you.
He did this, and Roger stood silently by as he got his coat and went to the door. He turned, and Roger embraced him clumsily but with surprising strength. Vic hugged him back, his cheek against Roger's shoulder.
I'll pray to God everything's okay, Roger said hoarsely.
Okay, Vic said, and went out.
The elevator hummed faintly on the way down, not really moving at all, he thought. It's a sound effect. Two drunks supporting each other got on at lobby level as he got off.
Extras, he thought.
He spoke to the doorman, another extra, and after about 5 minutes, a cab rolled up to the Blue Hotel awning. The cab driver was black and silent. He had his radio tuned to an FM soul station. The Temptations sang power endlessly as the cab took him toward Logan Airport through streets that were almost completely deserted.
Hell of a good movie set,
he thought. As the Temptations faded out, a jive-ass DJ came on with the weather forecast. It had been hot yesterday, he reported, but you didn't see nothing yesterday, brothers and sisters. Today was going to be the hottest day of the summer so far, maybe a record breaker. The Big G's weather prognosticator, Altitude Lou McNally, was calling for temperatures of over 100 degrees inland and not much cooler on the coast. A mass of warm, stagnant air had moved up from the south and was being held in place over New England by bands of high pressure. So, if your gas gonna reach, you're gonna head for the beach, the jive-ass DJ finished. It ain't gonna be too pretty if you hangin' out in the city. And just to prove the point, here's Michael Jackson. He's going off the wall. The forecast meant little or nothing to Vic, but it would have terrified Donna even more than she already was, had she known. As she had the day before, Charity awoke just before dawn. She awoke listening, and for a few moments she wasn't even sure what she was listening for. Then she remembered. Boards creaking, footsteps. She was listening to see if her son was going to go walking again. But the house was silent. She got out of bed, went to the door, and looked out into the hall. The hall was empty. After a moment's debate, she went down to Brett's room and looked in on him. There was nothing showing under his sheet but a lick of his hair. If he had gone walking, he had done it before she woke up. He was deeply asleep now. Charity went back to her room and sat on her bed, looking out at the faint white line on the horizon. She was aware that her decision had been made, somehow, secretly, in the night while she slept. Now, in the first cold light of day, she was able to examine what she had decided, and she felt that she could count the cost. It occurred to her that she had never unburdened herself to her sister Holly as she had expected she would do. She still might have, if not for the credit cards at lunch yesterday. And then last night she had told Charity how much this, that, and the other had cost, the Buick four-door, the Sony color set, the parquet floor in the hallway. As if, in Holly's mind, each of these things still carried invisible price tags, and always would. Charity still liked her sister. Holly was giving and kind-hearted, impulsive, affectionate, warm. But her way of living had forced her to close off some of the heartless truths about the way she and Charity had grown up poor in rural Maine, the truths that had more or less forced Charity into marriage with Joe Camber, while luck, really no different from Charity's winning lottery ticket, had allowed Holly to meet Jim and escape the life back home forever. She was afraid that if she told Holly that she had been trying to get Joe's permission to come down here for years, that this trip had only occurred because of brutal generalship on her part, and that even so it had almost come down to Joe strapping her with his leather belt. She was afraid that if she told Holly those things, her sister's reaction would be horrified anger rather than anything rational and helpful. Why horrified anger? Perhaps because deep down in a part of the human soul where Buick station wagons and Sony color TVs with Trinitron picture tubes and parquet floors can never quite make their final stilling impact, Holly would recognize that she might have escaped a similar marriage, a similar life, by the thinnest of margins. She hadn't told because Holly had entrenched herself in her upper-middle-class suburban life like a watchful soldier in a foxhole. She hadn't told because horrified anger could not solve her problems. She hadn't told because no one likes to look like a freak in a sideshow, living through the days and weeks and months and years with an unpleasant, uncommunicative, sometimes frightening man. Charity had discovered there were things you didn't want to tell. Shame wasn't the reason. Sometimes it was just better, kinder, to keep up a front. Mostly she hadn't told because these things were her problems. What happened to Brett was her problem.
And over the last 2 days, she had come more and more to believe that what he did with his life would depend less on her and Joe in the final reckoning than it would on Brett himself. There would be no divorce. She would continue to fight her unceasing guerrilla war with Joe for the boy's soul, for whatever good that would do. In her worry over Brett's wanting to emulate his father, she had perhaps forgotten, or overlooked, the fact that there comes a time when children stand in judgment, and their parents, mother as well as father, must stand in the dock. Brett had noticed Holly's ostentatious display of credit cards. Charity could only hope Brett would notice that his father ate with his hat on, among other things. The dawn was brightening. She took her robe from the back of the door and put it on. She wanted a shower, but would not take one until the others in the house were stirring. The strangers, that was what they were. Even Holly's face was strange to her now, a face that bore only a faint resemblance to the snapshots in the family albums she had brought with them. Even Holly herself had looked at those photographs with a faint air of puzzlement. They would go back to Castle Rock, back to the house at the end of Town Road Number 3, back to Joe. She would pick up the threads of her life, and things would continue. That would be best. She reminded herself to call Alva just before 7 o'clock, when he would be at breakfast. It was just past 6 a.m., and the day was coming bright when Tad had his convulsion. He had awakened from an apparently sound sleep around 5:15 and had roused Donna from a low doze, complaining of being hungry and thirsty. As if he had pressed a button deep down inside her, Donna had become aware for the first time that she was hungry too. The thirst she had been aware of, it was more or less constant, but she could not remember actually thinking of food since sometime yesterday morning. Now she was suddenly ravenous. She soothed Tad as best she could, telling him hollow things that no longer meant anything real to her one way or another, that people would show up soon, the bad dog would be taken away, they would be rescued. The real thing was the thought of food. Breakfasts, for instance. Take breakfasts. 2 eggs fried in butter, over easy if you don't mind, waiter. French toast, big glasses of fresh-squeezed orange juice so cold that moisture beaded the glass, Canadian bacon, home fries, bran flakes and cream with a sprinkle of blueberries on top, bluebies, her father had always called them, another one of those comic irrationalities that had irritated her mother out of all proportion. Her stomach made a loud rumbling sound, and Tad laughed. The sound of his laughter startled her and pleased her with its unexpectedness. It was like finding a rose growing in a rubbish heap, and she smiled back. The smile hurt her lips.
Heard that, huh? I think you must be hungry, too.
Well, I wouldn't turn down an Egg McMuffin if someone threw it my way.
Tad groaned, and that made them both laugh again. In the yard, Cujo had pricked up his ears. He growled at the sound of their laughter. For a moment, he made as if to get to his feet, perhaps to charge the car again. Then he settled wearily back on his haunches, head drooping. Donna felt that irrational lift in her spirits that almost always comes with daybreak.
Surely it would be over soon. Surely they had passed the worst. All the luck had been against them, but sooner or later, even the worst luck changes.
Tad seemed almost his old self, too pale, badly used, terribly tired in spite of his sleep, but still indubitably the Tadder. She hugged him, and he hugged her back. The pain in her belly had subsided somewhat, although the scrapes and gouges there had a puffy, inflamed look. Her leg was worse, but she found she was able to flex it,
although it hurt to do so, and the bleeding started again. She would have a scar.
The two of them talked for the next 40 minutes or so, Donna, hunting for a way to keep Tad alert and to also pass the time for both of them, suggested 20 questions. Tad agreed eagerly. He had never been able to get enough of the game. The only problem had always been getting one or the other of his parents to play it with him. They were on their fourth game when the convulsion struck. Donna had guessed some 5 questions ago that the subject of the interrogation was Fred Redding, one of Tad's day camp chums, but had been spinning things out. "Does he have red hair?" she said.
"No, he's...
Suddenly, Tad was struggling to catch his breath. It came and went in gasping, tearing whoops that caused fear to leap up her throat in a sour, coppery-tasting rush. "Tad? Tad?" Tad gasped. He clawed at his throat, leaving red lines there. His eyes rolled up, showing only the bottoms of the irises and the silvery whites. "Tad!" She grabbed him, shook him. His Adam's apple went up and down rapidly, like a mechanical bear on a stick. His hands began to flop aimlessly about, and then they rose to his throat again and tore at it. He began to make animal choking sounds. For a moment, Donna entirely forgot where she was. She grabbed for the door handle, pulled it up, and shoved the door of the Pinto open, as if this had happened while she was in the supermarket parking lot and there was help close by. Cujo was on his feet in an instant. He leaped at the car before the door was more than half open, perhaps saving her from being savaged at that instant. He struck the opening door, fell back, and then came again, snarling thickly. Loose excrement poured onto the crushed gravel of the driveway. Screaming, she yanked the door closed. Cujo leaped at the side of the car again, bashing the dent in a little deeper. He reeled back, then sprang at the window, thudding off it with a dull cracking sound. The silver crack running through the glass suddenly developed 6 tributaries. He leaped at it again, and the safety glass starred inward, still holding together, but sagging now. The outside world was suddenly a milky blur. If he comes again... Instead, Cujo withdrew, waiting to see what she would do next. She turned to her son. Tad's entire body was jerking as if with epilepsy. His back was bowed, his buttocks came out of the seat, thumped back, rose again, thumped back. His face was taking on a bluish color. The veins in his temples stood out prominently. She had been a candy striper for 3 years, her last 2 in high school and the summer following her freshman year at college, and she knew what was happening here. He had not swallowed his tongue. Outside of the more purple mystery novels, that was impossible. But his tongue had slid down his throat and was now blocking his windpipe. He was choking to death in front of her eyes. She grabbed his chin in her left hand and yanked his mouth open. Panic made her rough, and she heard the tendons in his jaw creak. Her probing fingers found the tip of his tongue incredibly far back, almost to where his wisdom teeth would be if they ever grew out. She tried to grip it and couldn't. It was wet and slippery as a baby eel. She tried to squeeze it between her thumb and forefinger, only faintly aware of the lunatic race of her heart. "I think I'm losing him," she thought. "Oh, my dear God, I think I'm losing my son." Now his teeth suddenly clashed down, drawing blood from her probing fingers and from his own cracked and blistered lips. Blood ran down his chin. She was hardly aware of the pain. Tad's feet began to rattle a mad tattoo against the floor mat of the Pinto. She groped for the tip of his tongue desperately. She had it, and it slipped through her fingers again. "The dog! The goddamn dog! It's his fault! Goddamn dog! Goddamn hellhound! I'll kill you, I swear to God!" Tad's teeth clamped down on her fingers again, and then she had his tongue again, and this time she did not hesitate.
She dug her fingernails into its spongy top and underside and pulled it forward like a woman pulling a window shade down. At the same time, she put her other hand under his chin and tipped his head back, creating the maximum airway. Tad began to gasp again, a harsh, rattling sound, like the breathing of an old man with emphysema. Then he began to whoop. She slapped him. She didn't know what else to do, so she did that. Tad uttered one final, tearing gasp, and then his breathing settled into a rapid pant. She was panting herself. Waves of dizziness rushed over her. She had twisted her bad leg somehow, and there was the warm wetness of fresh bleeding. Tad, she swallowed harshly. Tad, can you hear me? His head nodded, a little. His eyes remained closed. Take it as easy as you can. I want you to relax.
Want to go home, Mommy? The monster.
Shh, Tadder. Don't talk and don't think about monsters. Here. The monster words had fallen to the floor. She picked the yellow paper up and put it in his hand. Tad gripped it with panicky tightness. Now, concentrate on breathing slowly and regularly, Tad. That's the way to get home. Slow and regular breaths. Her eyes wandered past him, and once again she saw the splintery bat, its handle wrapped in friction tape, lying in the high weeds at the right side of the driveway. Just take it easy, Tadder. Can you try to do that? Tad nodded a little without opening his eyes. Just a little longer, hun. I promise. I promise. Outside, the day continued to brighten. Already it was warm. The temperature inside the small car began to climb. Vic got home at 5:20. At the time his wife was pulling his son's tongue out of the back of his mouth, he was walking around the living room, putting things slowly and dreamily to rights, while Bannerman, a state police detective, and a detective from the state attorney general's office, sat on the long sectional sofa drinking instant coffee.
"I've already told you everything I know," Vic said. "If she isn't with the people you've contacted already, she's not with anybody."
He had a broom and a dustpan, and he had brought in the box of hefty bags from the kitchen closet. Now he let a pan full of broken glass slide into one of the bags with an atonal jingle.
"Unless it's Kemp."
There was an uncomfortable silence. Vic couldn't remember ever being as tired as he was now, but he didn't believe he would be able to sleep unless someone gave him a shot. He wasn't thinking very well. 10 minutes after he arrived, the telephone had rung, and he had sprung at it like an animal, not heeding the AG's man's mild statement that it was probably for him. It hadn't been. It was Roger, wanting to know if Vic had gotten there and if there was any news. There was some news, but all of it was maddeningly inconclusive. There had been fingerprints all over the house, and a fingerprint team, also from Augusta, had taken a number of sets from the living quarters adjacent to the small stripping shop where Stephen Kemp had worked until recently. Before long, the matching would be done, and they would know conclusively if Kemp had been the one who had turned the downstairs floor upside down. To Vic, it was so much redundancy. He knew in his guts that it had been Kemp. The state police detective had run a make on Kemp's van. It was a 1971 Ford Econoline, Maine license 641644. The color was light gray, but they knew from Kemp's landlord, they had routed him out of bed at 4 a.m., that the van had desert murals painted on the sides, buttes, mesas, sand dunes. There were two bumper stickers on the rear, one which said "Split Wood, not Adams," and one which said "Ronald Reagan shot J.R." A very funny guy, Steve Kemp. But the murals and the bumper stickers would make the van easier to identify, and unless he had ditched it, he would almost certainly be spotted before the day was out. The MV alert had gone out to all the New England states and to upstate New York. In addition, the FBI in Portland and Boston had been alerted to a possible kidnapping, and they were now running Steve Kemp's name through their files in Washington. They would find three minor busts dating back to the Vietnam War protests, one each for the years 1968 to 1970.
"There's only one thing about all of this that bothers me," the AG's man said.
His pad was on his knee, but anything Vic could tell, he had already told them. The man from Augusta was only doodling.
"If I may be frank, it bothers the shit out of me."
"What's that?" Vic asked. He picked up the family portrait, looking down at it, and then tilted it so the shattered glass facing tumbled into the hefty bag with another evil little jingle.
"The car. Where's your wife's car?"
His name was Mason, Mason with an E, he had informed Vic as they shook hands. Now he went to the window, slapping his pad absently against his leg. Vic's battered sports car was in the driveway, parked to one side of Bannerman's cruiser. Vic had picked it up at the Portland jetport and dropped off the Avis car he had driven north from Boston.
"What's that got to do with it?" Vic asked.
Mason shrugged.
"Maybe nothing. Maybe something. Maybe everything. Probably nothing, but I just don't like it. Kemp comes here, right? Grabs your wife and son. Why? He's crazy. That's reason enough. Can't stand to lose. Maybe it's even his twisted idea of a joke."
These were all things Vic himself had said, repeated back almost verbatim.
"So what does he do? He bundles them into his Ford van with the desert murals on the sides. He's either running with them or he's holed up somewhere, right?"
"Yes, that's what I'm afraid." Mason turned from the window to look at him.
"So, where's her car?"
"Well..." Vic tried hard to think. It was hard. He was very tired.
"Maybe..."
"Maybe he had a Confederate who drove it away," Mason said. "That would probably mean a kidnapping for ransom. If he took them on his own, it was probably just a crazy spur-of-the-moment thing. If it was a kidnapping for money, why take the car at all? To switch over to? Ridiculous. That Pinto's every bit as hot as the van, if a little harder to recognize. And I repeat, if there was no Confederate, if he was by himself, who drove the car?"
"Maybe he came back for it," the state police detective rumbled. "Stowed the boy and the missus and came back for her car."
"That would present some problems without a Confederate," Mason said. "But I suppose he could do it. Take them someplace close and walk back for Mrs. Trenton's Pinto. Or take them someplace far away and thumb a ride back. But why?" Bannerman spoke for the first time.
"She could have driven it herself."
Mason swung to look at him, his eyebrows going up.
"If he took the boy with him..."
Bannerman looked at Vic and nodded a little.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Trenton, but if Kemp took the boy with him, belted him in, held a gun on him, and told your wife to follow close, and that something might happen to the boy if she tried anything clever, like turning off or flashing her lights."
Vic nodded, feeling sick at the picture it made. Mason seemed irritated with Bannerman, perhaps because he hadn't thought of the possibility himself.
"I repeat, to what purpose?"
Bannerman shook his head. Vic himself couldn't think of a single reason why Kemp would want Donna's car. Mason lit a pell-mell, coughed, and looked around for an ashtray.
"I'm sorry," Vic said, again feeling like an actor, someone outside himself, saying lines that had been written for him.
The two ashtrays in here were broken. I'll get you one from the kitchen.
Mason walked out with him, took an ashtray, and said, Let's go out on the steps. Do you mind?
It's going to be a bitch of a hot day. I like to enjoy them while they're still civilized during July.
Okay, Vic said listlessly.
He glanced at the thermometer barometer screwed to the side of the house as they went out, a gift from Donna last Christmas. The temperature already stood at 73. The needle of the barometer was planted squarely in the quadrant marked fair.
Let's pursue this a little further, Mason said. It fascinates me. Here's a woman with a son, a woman whose husband is away on a business trip. She needs her car if she's going to get around very well. Even downtown's half a mile away, and the walk back is all uphill. So, if we assume that Kemp grabbed her here, the car would still be here. Try this instead. Kemp comes up and trashes the house, but he's still furious. He sees them someplace else in town and grabs them. In that case, the car would still be in that other place, downtown maybe, or in the parking lot at the shopping center. Wouldn't someone have tagged it in the middle of the night? Vic asked.
Probably, Mason said.
Do you think she herself might have left it somewhere, Mr. Trenton?
Then Vic remembered the needle valve.
You look like something just clicked, Mason said.
It didn't click. It clunked. The car isn't here because it's at the Ford dealership in South Paris. She was having carburetor trouble. The needle valve in there kept wanting to jam. We talked about it on the phone Monday afternoon. She was really pissed off and upset about it. I meant to make an appointment for her to get it done by a local guy here in town, but I forgot because...
He trailed off, thinking about the reasons why he had forgotten.
You forgot to make the appointment here in town, so she would have taken it to South Paris?
Yeah, I guess so.
He couldn't remember exactly what the run of the conversation had been now, except that she had been afraid the car would seize up while she was taking it to be fixed. Mason glanced at his watch and got up. Vic started to rise with him.
No, stay put. I just want to make a quick phone call. I'll be back.
Vic sat where he was. The screen door banged closed behind Mason, a sound that reminded him so much of Tad that he winced and had to grit his teeth against fresh tears.
Where were they?
The thing about the Pinto not being here had only been momentarily promising, after all.
The sun was fully up now, throwing a bright rose light over the houses and the streets below and across Castle Hill. It touched the swing set where he had pushed Tad times without number. All he wanted was to push his son on the swing again, with his wife standing beside him. He would push until his hands fell off, if that was what Tad wanted.
Daddy, I wanna loop the loop. I wanna...
The voice in his mind chilled his heart. It was like a ghost voice. The screen door opened again a moment later. Mason sat down beside him and lit a fresh cigarette.
Twin City Ford in South Paris, he said. That was the one, wasn't it?
Yeah, we bought the Pinto there.
I took a shot and called them. Got lucky. The service manager was already in. Your Pinto's not there, and it hasn't been there. Who's the local guy?
Joe Camber, Vic said.
She must have taken the car out there after all. She didn't want to because he's way out in the back of beyond, and she couldn't get any answer on the phone when she called. I told her he was probably there anyway, just working in the garage. It's this converted barn, and I don't think he's got a phone in there. At least he didn't the last time I was out there.
We'll check it out, Mason said.
But her car's not there either, Mr. Trenton. Depend on it.
Why not?
Doesn't make a bit of logical sense, Mason said. I was 95% sure it wasn't in South Paris either. Look, everything we said before still holds true. A young woman with a child needs a car. Suppose she took the car over to Twin City Ford and they told her it was going to be a couple of days. How does she get back?
Well, a loaner. Or if they wouldn't give her a loaner, I guess they'd rent her one of their lease cars from the cheap fleet.
Right. Beautiful. So where is it?
Vic looked at the driveway, almost as if expecting it to appear.
There'd be no more reason for Kemp to abscond with your wife's loaner than there would be for him to abscond with her Pinto, Mason said. That pretty well ruled out the Ford dealership in advance. Now, let's say she takes it out to this guy Camber's garage. If he gives her an old junker to run around in while he fixes her Pinto, we're back at square one right away. Where's the junker? So let's say that she takes it up there, and Camber says he'll have to keep it a while, but he's got nothing he can give her to get back to town in. So she calls a friend, and a friend comes out to pick her up. With me so far?
Yes, sure.
So, who's the friend?
You gave us a list, and we got them all out of bed. Lucky they were all home, it being summer and all. None of them mentioned bringing your people home from anywhere. No one has seen them any later than Monday morning.
Well, why don't we stop crapping around? Vic asked. Let's give Camber a call and find out for sure.
Let's wait until 7, Mason said. That's only 15 minutes. Give him a chance to get his face washed and wake up a little. Service managers usually clock in early. This guy's an independent.
Vic shrugged. This whole thing was a crazy blind alley. Kemp had Donna and Tad. He knew it in his guts, just as he knew it was Kemp who had trashed the house and shot his cum on the bed he and Donna shared.
Of course, it didn't have to be a friend, Mason said, dreamily watching his cigarette smoke drift off into the morning. There are all sorts of possibilities. She gets the car up there, and someone she knows slightly happens to be there, and the guy or gal offers Mrs. Trenton and your son a ride back into town. Or maybe Camber runs them home himself. Or his wife. Is he married?
Yes. Nice woman.
Could have been him, her, anyone. People are always willing to help a lady in distress.
Yeah, Vic said and lit a cigarette of his own.
But none of that matters either, because the question always remains the same. Where's the fucking car? Because the situation's the same. Woman and kid on their own. She has to get groceries, go to the dry cleaners, go to the post office, dozens of little errands. If the husband was only going to be gone a few days, a week even, she might try to get along without a car. But 10 days or 2 weeks? Jesus, that's a long haul in a town that's only got one goddamn cab. Rental car people are happy to deliver in a situation like that. She could have gotten Hertz or Avis or National to deliver the car here or out to Camber's. So where's the rental car? I keep coming back to that. There should have been a vehicle in this yard. Dig?
I don't think it's important, Vic said.
And probably it's not. We'll find some simple explanation and say, oy vey, how could we be so stupid? But it fascinates me strangely.
It was the needle valve? You're sure of that?
Positive.
Mason shook his head.
Why would she need all that rigmarole about loaners or rental cars anyway? That's a 15-minute fix for somebody with the tools and the know-how. Drive in, drive out. So where's her goddamn car?
Vic finished wearily. The world was coming and going in waves now.
Why don't you go upstairs and lie down? Mason said. You look wiped out.
No, I want to be awake if something happens.
And if something does, somebody will be here to wake you up. The FBI's coming with a traceback system to hook up to your phone. Those people are noisy enough to wake the dead, so don't worry.
Vic was too tired to feel much more than a dull dread.
Do you think that traceback shit is really necessary?
Better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it, Mason said, and pitched his cigarette. Get a little rest and you'll be able to cope better, Vic. Go on.
All right.
He went slowly upstairs. The bed had been stripped to the mattress. He had done it himself. He put two pillows on his side, took off his shoes, and lay down. The morning sun shone fiercely in through the window.
I won't sleep, he thought. But I'll rest. I'll try to, anyway. 15 minutes, maybe half an hour.
But by the time the phone woke him up, that day's burning noon had come. Charity Camber had her morning coffee and then called Alva Thornton in Castle Rock. This time, Alva himself answered. He knew that she had chatted with Bessie the night before.
Nope, Alva said. I ain't seen hide nor hair of Joe since last Thursday or so, Charity. He brought over a tractor tire he fixed for me. Never said nothing about feeding Cujo, although I'd have been happy to.
Alva, could you run up to the house and check on Cujo? Brett saw him Monday morning before we left for my sister's, and he thought he looked sick. And I just don't know who Joe would have gotten to feed him.
After the way of country people, she added, no hurry.
I'll take a run up and check, Alva said. Let me get those damn cactus fed and watered, and I'm gone.
That would be fine, Alva, Charity said gratefully, and gave him her sister's number. Thanks so much. They talked a little more, mostly about the weather. The constant heat had Alva worried about his chickens. Then she hung up. Brett looked up from his cereal when she came into the kitchen. Jim Jr. was very carefully making rings on the table with his orange juice glass and talking a mile a minute. He had decided sometime during the last 48 hours that Brett Camber was a close relation to Jesus Christ.
Well, Brett asked.
You were right. Dad didn't ask Alva to feed him.
She saw the disappointment and worry on Brett's face and went on.
But he's going up to check on Cujo this morning, as soon as he's got his chickens tended to. I left the number this time. He said he'd call back one way or the other.
Thanks, Mom.
Jim clattered back from the table as Holly called him to come upstairs and get dressed.
Want to come up with me, Brett?
Brett smiled.
I'll wait for you, slugger.
Okay.
Jim ran out, trumpeting.
Mom, Brett said he'd wait. Brett's gonna wait for me to get dressed.
A thunder as of elephants on the stairs.
He's a nice kid, Brett said casually.
I thought, Charity said, that we might go home a little early, if that's all right with you.
Brett's face brightened, and in spite of all the decisions she had come to, that brightness made her feel a little sad.
When? He asked.
How does tomorrow sound?
She had been intending to suggest Friday.
Great, but...
He looked at her closely.
Are you done visiting, Mom? I mean, she's your sister.
Charity thought of the credit cards and of the Wurlitzer jukebox Holly's husband had been able to afford but did not know how to fix. Those were the things that had impressed Brett, and she supposed they had impressed her as well in some way. Perhaps she had seen them through Brett's eyes a little.
Through Joe's eyes.
And enough was enough.
Yes, she said. I guess I'm done with my visitin'. I'll tell Holly this morning.
Okay, Mom.
He looked at her a little shyly.
I wouldn't mind coming back, you know. I do like them. And he's a neat little kid. Maybe he can come up to Maine sometime.
Yes, she said, surprised and grateful. She didn't think Joe would object to that.
Yes, maybe that could be arranged.
Okay.
and tell me what Mr. Thornton said.
I will. But Alva never called back. As he was feeding his chickens that morning, the motor in his big air conditioner blew, and he was immediately in a life-or-death struggle to save his birds before the day's heat could kill them. Donna Trenton might have called it another stroke of that same fate she saw reflected in Cujo's muddy, homicidal eyes. By the time the issue of the air conditioner was settled, it was 4 in the afternoon. Alva Thornton lost 62 chickens that day and counted himself off cheaply. And the confrontation which had begun Monday afternoon in the Cambers' sun-struck dooryard was over. Andy Mason was the Maine Attorney General's wunderkind, and there were those who said that someday, and not too distant a day either, he would lead the AG's criminal division. Andy Mason's sights were set a good deal higher than that. He hoped to be the Attorney General himself in 1984, and in a position to run for governor by 1987. And after 8 years as governor, who knew? He came from a large, poor family. He and his 3 brothers and 2 sisters had grown up in a ramshackle, poor, white trash house on the outer Sabbatus Road in the town of Lisbon. His brothers and sisters had been exactly up or down to town expectations. Only Andy Mason and his youngest brother, Marty, had managed to finish high school. For a while, it had looked as if Roberta might make it, but she had gotten herself knocked up higher than a kite following a dance her senior year. She had left school to marry the boy who still had pimples at 29, drank Narragansett straight from the can, and knocked both her and the kid around. Marty had been killed in a car crash over on Route 9 in Durham. He and some of his drunk friends had tried to take the tight curve up Seroy Hill at 70. The Camaro in which they were riding rolled over twice and burned. Andy had been the star of the family, but his mother had never liked him. She was a little afraid of him. When talking to friends, she would say, "My Andy's a cold fish." But he was more than that. He was always tightly controlled, always buttoned up. He knew from the 5th grade on that he was going to somehow get through college and become a lawyer. Lawyers made a lot of money. Lawyers worked with logic. Logic was Andy's god. He saw each event as a point from which a finite number of possibilities radiated. At the end of each possibility line was another event point, and so on. This point-to-point blueprint of life had served him very well. He made straight A's through grammar school and high school, got a merit scholarship, and could have gone to college almost anywhere. He decided on the University of Maine, throwing away his chance at Harvard, because he had already decided to start his career in Augusta, and he didn't want some piney woodser in gum-rubber boots and a lumberman's jacket throwing Harvard in his face. On this hot July morning, things were right on schedule. He put Vic Trenton's phone down. There had been no answer at the Camber telephone number. The state police detective and bannerman were still here, waiting for instructions like well-trained dogs. He had worked with Townsend, the state police guy, before, and he was the sort of fellow Andy Mason felt comfortable with. When you said fetch, Townsend fetched. Bannerman was a new one, and Mason didn't care for him. His eyes were a little too bright, and the way he had suddenly come out with the idea that Kemp might have coerced the woman by using the kid— Well, such ideas, if they were going to come, ought to come from Andy Mason. The 3 of them sat on the sectional sofa, not talking, just drinking coffee and waiting for the FBI guys to show up with the traceback equipment. Andy thought about the case. It might be a tempest in a teapot, but it might well be something more. The husband was convinced it was a kidnapping and attached no importance to the missing car. He was fixated on the idea that Stephen Kemp had taken his people. Andy Mason was not so sure. Camber wasn't home. No one was home up there. Maybe they had all gone on vacation.
That was likely enough. July was the quintessential vacation month, and they had been due to hit someone who was gone. Would he have taken her car in for a repair job if he was going away? Unlikely. Unlikely that the car was there at all. But it had to be checked, and there was one possibility he had neglected to mention to Vic. Suppose she had taken the car up to Camber's garage. Suppose someone had offered her a lift back. Not a friend, not an acquaintance, not Camber or his wife, but a total stranger. Andy could hear Trenton saying, "Oh no, my wife would never accept a ride from a stranger." But in the vernacular, she had accepted several rides from Steve Kemp, who was almost a stranger. If the hypothetical man was friendly, and if she was anxious to get her son home, she might have accepted. And maybe the nice, smiling man was some kind of freak. They had had just such a freak here in Castle Rock before, Frank Dodd. Maybe the nice, smiling man had left them in the brush with their throats cut and had hied on his merry way. If that was the case, the Pinto would be at Camber's. Andy did not think this line of reasoning likely, but it was possible. He would have to send a man up to the Camber's anyway. It was routine. But he liked to understand why he was doing each thing he was doing. He thought that for all practical purposes, he could dismiss Camber's garage from the structure of logic and order he was building. He supposed she could have gone up there, discovered the Cambers were gone, and then had her car conk out on her. But Castle Rock's Town Road Number 3 was hardly Antarctica. She and the kid had only to walk to the nearest house and ask to use the phone in that case. But they hadn't done it. "Mr. Townsend," he said in his soft voice, "you and Sheriff Bannerman here ought to take a ride out to this Joe Camber's garage. Verify three things. No blue Pinto there, license number 218864, no Donna and Theodore Trenton there, no Camber's there. Got that?" "Fine," Townsend said. "Do you want—"
"I want only those three things," Andy said softly. He didn't like the way Bannerman was looking at him with a kind of weary contempt. It upset him. "If any of those three are there, call me here. And if I'm not here, I'll leave a number. Understand?"
The telephone rang. Bannerman picked it up, listened, and offered it to Andy Mason.
"For you, hot shot."
Their eyes locked over the telephone. Mason thought that Bannerman would drop his, but he didn't. After a moment, Andy took the phone. The call was from the state police barracks in Scarborough. Steve Kemp had been picked up. His van had been spotted in the courtyard of a small motel in the Massachusetts town of Twickenham. The woman and the boy were not with him. After receiving the Miranda, Kemp had given his name and had since been standing on his right to remain silent. Andy Mason found that extremely ominous news.
"Townsend, you come with me," he said. "You can handle the Camber place by yourself, can't you, Sheriff Bannerman?"
"It's my town," Bannerman said.
Andy Mason lit a cigarette and looked at Bannerman through the shifting smoke.
"Have you got a problem with me, Sheriff?"
Bannerman smiled.
"Nothing I can't handle."
"Christ, I hate these hicks," Mason thought, watching Bannerman leave. "But he's out of the play now, anyway. Thank God for small favors."
Bannerman got behind the wheel of his cruiser, fired it up, and backed out of the Trenton driveway. It was 7:20. He was almost amused at how neatly Mason had shunted him off onto a siding. They were headed toward the heart of the matter. He was headed nowhere.
But old Hank Townsend was going to have to listen to a whole morning's worth of Mason's bullshit. So maybe he had gotten off well at that.
George Bannerman loafed out Route 117 toward the Maple Sugar Road, siren and flashers off. It surely was a pretty day.
and he saw no need to hurry.
Donna and Tad Trenton were sleeping. Their positions were very similar, the awkward sleeping positions of those forced to spend long hours on interstate buses. Their heads lolled against the sockets of their shoulders, Donna's turned to the left, Tad's to the right. Tad's hands lay in his lap like beached fish. Now and again they would twitch. His breathing was harsh and stertorous. His lips were blistered, his eyelids a purplish color, a line of spittle running from the corner of his mouth to the soft line of his jaw had begun to dry. Donna was in middle sleep. As exhausted as she was, her cramped position and the pain in her leg and belly and now her fingers, in his seizure Tad had bitten them to the bone, would let her sink no deeper. Her hair clung to her head in sweaty strings. The gauze pads on her left leg had soaked through again, and the flesh around the superficial wounds on her belly had gone an ugly red. Her breathing was also harsh, but not as uneven as Tad's. Tad Trenton was very close to the end of his endurance. Dehydration was well advanced. He had lost electrolytes, chlorides, and sodium through his perspiration. Nothing had replaced them. His inner defenses were being steadily rolled back, and now he had entered the final critical stage. His life had grown light, not sunken firmly into his flesh and bones, but trembling, ready to depart on any puff of wind. In his feverish dreams, his father pushed him on the swing, higher and higher, and he did not see their backyard, but the duck pond, and the breeze was cool on his sunburned forehead, his aching eyes, his blistered lips.
Cujo also slept. He lay on the verge of grass by the porch, his mangled snout on his forepaws. His dreams were confused, lunatic things. It was dusk and the sky was dark with wheeling red-eyed bats. He leaped at them again and again, and each time he leaped he brought one down, teeth clamped on a leathery, twitching wing. But the bats kept biting his tender face with their sharp little rat teeth. That was where the pain came from. That was where all the hurt came from. But he would kill them all. He would.
He woke suddenly, his head lifting from his paws, his head cocking.
A car was coming.
To his hellishly alert ears, the sound of the approaching car was dreadful, insupportable. It was the sound of some great stinging insect coming to fill him with poison. He lurched to his feet, whining. All his joints seemed filled with crushed glass. He looked at the dead car. Inside, he could see the unmoving outline of the woman's head. Before, Cujo had been able to look right through the glass and see her, but the woman had done something to the glass that made it hard to see. It didn't matter what she did to the windows. She couldn't get out. Nor the boy, either. The drone was closer now. The car was coming up the hill, but was it a car? Or a giant bee or wasp come to batten on him, to sting him, to make his pain even worse? Better wait and see. Cujo slunk under the porch, where he had often spent hot summer days in the past. It was drifted deep with the decaying autumn leaves of other years, leaves which released a smell he had thought incredibly sweet and pleasant in those same other years. Now the smell seemed immense and cloying, suffocating and well-nigh unbearable. He growled at the smell and began to slobber foam again. If a dog could kill a scent, Cujo would have killed this one. The drone was very close now, and then a car was turning into the driveway, a car with blue sides and a white roof and lights on the top. The one thing George Bannerman had been least prepared to see when he turned into Joe Camber's dooryard was the pinto belonging to the missing woman.
He was not a stupid man, and while he would have been impatient with Andy Mason's point-to-point kind of logic, he had dealt with the horror of Frank Dodd and understood that sometimes there was no logic. He arrived at his own mostly solid conclusions in much the same way, if on a more subconscious level. And he agreed with Mason's belief that it was highly unlikely the Trenton woman and her son would be here. But the car was here, anyway. Bannerman grabbed for the mic hung under his dashboard and then decided to check the car first. From this angle, directly behind the Pinto, it was impossible to see if anyone was in there or not. The backs of the bucket seats were a bit too high, and both Tad and Donna had slumped down in their sleep. Bannerman got out of the cruiser and slammed the door behind him. Before he had gotten two steps, he saw that the entire driver's side window was a buckled mass of shatter-shot cracks. His heart began to beat harder, and his hand went to the butt of his .38 police special. Cujo stared out at the man from the blue car with rising hate. It was this man who had caused all his pain. He felt sure of it. The man had caused the pain in his joints and the high, rotten singing in his head. It was the man's fault that the drift of old leaves here beneath the porch now smelled putrescent. It was the man's fault that he could not look at water without whining and shrinking away and wanting to kill it in spite of his great thirst. A growl began somewhere deep in his heavy chest as his legs coiled beneath him. He could smell the man, his oil of sweat and excitement, the heavy meat set against his bones. The growl deepened, then rose to a great and shattering cry of fury. He sprang out from beneath the porch and charged at this awful man who had caused his pain. During that first crucial moment, Bannerman didn't even hear Cujo's low, rising growl. He had approached the Pinto closely enough to see a mass of hair lying against the driver's side window. His first thought was that the woman must have been shot to death. But where was the bullet hole? The glass looked as if it had been bludgeoned, not shot. Then he saw the head move. Not much, only slight, but it had moved. The woman was alive. He stepped forward. And that was when Cujo's roar, followed by a volley of snarling barks, came. His first thought, Rusty, was of his Irish setter. But he'd had Rusty put down 4 years ago, not long after the Frank Dodd thing, and Rusty had never sounded like this. And for a second crucial moment, Bannerman was frozen in his tracks with a terrible atavistic horror. He turned then, pulling his gun, and caught just a blurred glimpse of a dog, an incredibly big dog, launching itself into the air at him. It struck him chest high, driving him against the Pinto's hatchback. He grunted. His right hand was driven up and his wrist struck the chrome guttering of the hatchback hard. His gun went flying. It whirled over the top of the car, butt for barrel and butt for barrel, to land in the high weeds on the other side of the driveway. The dog was biting him. And as Bannerman saw the first flowers of blood open on the front of his light blue shirt, he suddenly understood everything. They'd come here, their car had seized up, and the dog had been here. The dog hadn't been in Mason's neat little point-to-point analysis. Bannerman grappled with it, trying to get his hands under the dog's muzzle and bring it up and out of his belly. There was a sudden deep and numbing pain down there. His shirt was in tatters down there. Blood was pouring over his pants in a freshet. He lurched forward, and the dog drove him back with frightening force, drove him back against the Pinto with a thud that rocked the little car on its springs. He found himself trying to remember if he and his wife had made love last night. Crazy thing to be thinking. Crazy. The dog bored in again. Bannerman tried to dodge away, but the dog anticipated him. It was grinning at him. And suddenly there was more pain than he had ever felt in his life. It galvanized him.
Screaming, he got both hands under the dog's muzzle again and yanked it up. For a moment, staring into those dark, crazed eyes, a swoony kind of horror came over him, and he thought,
"Hello, Frank. It's you, isn't it? Was hell too hot for you?"
Then Cujo was snapping at his fingers, tearing them, laying them open. Bannerman forgot about Frank Dodd. He forgot about everything but trying to save his life. He tried to get his knee up between him and the dog and found he couldn't. When he tried to raise his knee, the pain in his lower belly flared to a sheeting agony.
"What's he done to me down there? Oh, my God, what's he done? Vicky? Vicky?"
Then the driver's side door of the Pinto opened. It was the woman. He had looked at the family portrait Steve Kemp had stepped on and had seen a pretty, neatly coiffed woman, the sort you look at twice on the street, the second look being mildly speculative.
You saw a woman like that and you thought that her husband was lucky to have her in the kip.
This woman was a ruin. The dog had been at her as well. Her belly was streaked with dried blood. One leg of her jeans had been chewed away, and there was a sopping bandage just over her knee. But her face was the worst. It was like a hideous baked apple. Her forehead had blistered and peeled. Her lips were cracked and suppurating. Her eyes were sunken in deep purple pouches of flesh. The dog left Bannerman in a flash and advanced on the woman, stiff-legged and growling. She retreated into the car and slammed the door.
"Cruiser now. Got to call in. Got to call this in."
He turned and ran back to the cruiser. The dog chased him, but he outran it. He slammed the door, grabbed the mic, and called for help. "Code 3, officer needs assistance." Help came. The dog was shot. They were all saved. All of this happened in just 3 seconds, and only in George Bannerman's mind. As he turned to go back to his police cruiser, his legs gave out and spilled him into the driveway.
"Oh, Vicky, what's he done to me down there?"
The world was all dazzling sun. It was hard to see. Bannerman scrambled, clawed at the gravel, and finally made it to his knees. He looked down at himself and saw a thick gray rope of intestine hanging out of his tattered shirt. His pants were soaked with blood to both knees.
Enough. The dog had done enough to him down there. "Hold your guts in, Bannerman. If you're stepping out, you're stepping out. But not until you get to that fucking mic and call this in. Hold your guts in and get on your big flat feet. The kid, Jesus, her kid in there?"
That made him think of his own daughter, Katrina, who would be going into the 7th grade this year. She was getting breasts now, becoming quite the little lady, piano lessons, wanted a horse. There had been a day when, if she had crossed from the school to the library alone, Dodd would have had her instead of Mary Kate Henderson. When...
"Move your ass!"
Bannerman got to his feet. Everything was sunshine and brightness, and all his insides seemed to want to slip out of the hole the dog had torn in him.
The car, the police radio.
Behind him, the dog was distracted. He was throwing himself crazily against the Pinto's buckled side door again and again, barking and snarling. Bannerman staggered toward the cruiser. His face was as white as pie dough. His lips were blue-gray.
It was the biggest dog he had ever seen. And it had gutted him. Gutted him, for Christ's sake. And why was everything so hot and so bright?
His intestines were slipping through his fingers. He reached the car door. He could hear the radio under the dash crackling out its message.
"Should have called in first. That's procedure. You never argue with procedure. But if I'd believed that, I never would have called Smith in the Dodd case. Vicky, Katrina, I'm sorry."
The boy. He had to get help for the boy. He almost fell and grabbed the edge of the door for support. And then he heard the dog coming for him, and he began to scream again. He tried to hurry. If he could only get the door shut. Oh, God, if only he could close the door before the dog got to him again. Oh, God. Oh, God. Tad was screaming again, screaming and clawing at his face, whipping his head from side to side as Cujo thudded against the door, making it rock. Tad, don't, honey, please, don't.
What, Daddy?
Suddenly, it stopped. Holding Tad against her breast, Donna turned her head in time to see Cujo strike the man as he tried to swing into his car. The force of it knocked his hand loose from the door. After that, she couldn't watch. She wished she could block her ears somehow as well from the sounds of Cujo finishing with whoever it had been. He hid, she thought hysterically. He heard the car coming, and he hid. The porch door. Now was the time to go for the porch door while Cujo was occupied. She put her hand on the door handle, yanked it, and shoved. Nothing happened. The door wouldn't open. Cujo had finally buckled the frame enough to seal it shut. Tad, she whispered feverishly. Tad, change places with me quick. Tad, Tad. Tad was shivering all over. His eyes had rolled up again.
Ducks, he said gutturally. Go see the ducks. Monster words. Daddy.
He was convulsing again. His arms flopped bonelessly. She began to shake him, crying his name over and over again, trying to keep his mouth open, trying to keep the airway open. There was a monstrous buzzing in her head, and she began to be afraid that she was going to faint. This was hell. They were in hell. The morning sun streamed into the car, creating the greenhouse effect, dry and remorseless. At last, Tad quieted. His eyes had closed again. His breathing was very rapid and shallow. When she put her fingers on his wrist, she found a runaway pulse, weak, thready, and irregular. She looked outside. Cujo had hold of the man's arm and was shaking it the way a puppy will shake a rag toy. Every now and then he would pounce on the limp body. The blood. There was so much blood. As if aware he was being observed, Cujo looked up, his muzzle dripping. He looked at her with an expression. Could a dog have an expression? She wondered madly. That seemed to convey both sternness and pity. And again Donna had the feeling that they had come to know each other intimately, and that there could be no stopping or resting for either of them until they had explored this terrible relationship to some ultimate conclusion. It pounced on the man in the blood-splattered blue shirt and khaki pants again. The dead man's head lolled on his neck. She looked away, her empty stomach sour with hot acid. Her torn leg ached and throbbed. She had torn the wound there open yet again. Tad, how was he now? He's terrible, her mind answered inexorably. So what are you going to do? You're his mother. What are you going to do? What could she do? Would it help Tad if she went out there and got herself killed? The policeman. Someone had sent the policeman up here, and when he didn't come back, please, she croaked, soon, please. It was 8 o'clock now, and outside it was still relatively cool, 77 degrees. By noon, the recorded temperature at the Portland Jetport would be 102, a new record for that date.